All right then, how are we doing? Are we feeling okay? Yeah? I think I'd like you to do something. You know, that whole participatory thing. I think I might just want you to kick off with something a bit participatory. Will you play with me?
Yeah!
Great. Stand up. Apart from Jake, you sit down.
Okay. There are people kind of standing there like this. What I need you to do is relax. Okay? We need to relax. So I need you to kind of shake. Ah, come on. Let it hang out a little bit more. Legs, arms. You can do your upper body, Jake. Okay. He's got bad knees, got teacher's note. Okay. All right, arms up. One leg, the other leg. Okay, this is the bit I really like. Bums. Fantastic. Okay, sit down.
You have no idea how beautiful you looked. I'm going to suggest that you don't bother with the whole kind of notebook and pen thing for this. Okay? I'd kind of rather that you just kind of relaxed into it and listened. Is that okay? I mean, you can do what you like, eh? But it's just a suggestion. I'm going to look more broadly at engaged Buddhism, which is why I gave myself the life, the title, gave myself a life. If only. I gave myself the title, Work, Life, and Lay Practice, because I thought, well, if I give myself that title, I can pretty much say anything, eh? All right. This was Friday's independent paper. And one of the titles is Storm Clouds Over St. Paul's. And the other one was Business as Usual, Top Directors Get 49% Raise. And I see a few people kind of shaking their heads. Okay, so we've got these economic protesters camped outside St. Paul's Cathedral in London. And by all accounts, the Dean of St. Paul's seemed to kind of approve of this form of protest. There were comparisons being made with Jesus overturning the tables of the moneylenders. On the other hand, Sunday services were cancelled there for the first time since the Second World War. They were going to be cancelled up until Christmas, but fortunately I kept my eye on the news and managed to cotton on that it's now open again. Okay. In response to the cathedral being shut, there was a flash mob of worshippers last Sunday evening outside the cathedral doing evensong. Flash mob evensong. Organised by Twitter, apparently. I did see a photograph of this Twitter-oriented mob. And I've got to say, they all looked pretty young to me. And I wonder if they were actually the people who'd have normally been at Evensong. But perhaps I'm just being cynical. So this business about the Church of England allowing protesters on their land, is this the church making a stand? Probably not. Because it's not encouraging the activity of protest from an institutional point of view. Rather, a given individual within the church has not prevented other individual protesters making their statement. So you might say it's more negative than positive. It's not stopping something rather than positively encouraging it. The church, depending which paper you read, according to the Telegraph, they were losing £16,000 a day with the cathedral being shut. If you read Time magazine, it was 20k. I don't know whether that's just to do with the exchange rate. But the fact that the church was talking about losing, let's call it 16k a day, suggests that some of them were less keen than others on this particular form of protest. And it occurred to me that religions do tend to have an ethical aspect to their makeup. Don't do this, or don't do that, or the Lord will smite those who do the other. The difficulty is that this encourages stance taking. And that results in kind of combative situations arising within the church, let alone between different branches. You need only look at the Church of England in relation to same-sex relationships. Poor Rowan Williams has been left trying to deal with the African churches who declare themselves more pure, more biblical, more right in their insistence on the unacceptability of a gay priesthood, a gay bishopric, or a gay congregation. Of course, you can say that all these things have a cultural aspect, which is right. But in my view, it's the insistence on views that creates the difficulties. Canon Dr. Giles Fraser has now apparently resigned. He was the third most senior member of St. Paul's. He has chosen to resign rather than be associated with an institution that may get people thrown off the site. Interestingly, he apparently has a brother or a brother-in-law who's some kind of investment banker, which is kind of ironic given the form of the protest. But anyway, the Church of England is basically getting its knickers in a twist about all of this, not surprisingly. Another thing. A few weeks ago, I think it was the 17th of October, a Tibetan nun self-immolated as a way of demonstrating her protest at the domination of China in Tibet. She was called Tenzin Wangmo. This is rather more shocking than the dean's failure to prevent his protesters. The form of protest is far more extreme. The outcome was a fatality. It's even more shocking because religious persons are not expected to kill themselves. Setting fire to yourself is a particular form of death. And of course, it does have precedence in the Vietnam War and Czech history, amongst other places. Death is against the Buddhist precepts. Can it therefore be right action? Clearly, the nun felt that it was, or that if it was not, that the end justified the means. She was the seventh monastic to set themselves alight in very recent times, so others too clearly felt that this was the only course of action open to them. As she performed the act, she called for the freedom of Tibet and the return of the Dalai Lama. It all gets a bit difficult, doesn't it? So a question I want to ask is this. Should a religious institution involve itself in politics, be that legislative politics, economic politics, or indeed sexual politics? Or is it better that individuals make their positions known and act on them? Is there a difference between institutionally founded and funded works and the exercise of political influence? Rather a long time ago, I did a degree in politics and history. And I did my thesis on the values of Victorian philanthropy in northern towns. It was a comparative study between Bolton and Manchester, if anybody's interested, and you're probably not. And what I discovered, not too surprisingly, was that many of those institutions supporting the poor and the disadvantaged were religiously based. Many, even most, it was actually quite hard to find something that went against the rule. They expected behavioural change in exchange for their largesse. We will give you food and shelter if you sign the pledge and give up alcohol. We will feed you if you sit through a religious service. We will give your children boots for their feet if you send them to our Sunday school. Few were completely altruistic in respect of expecting nothing in return for their donation. Do we have this problem in Buddhism? Well, as illustrated by Tenzin Wangmo, the Tibetan nun, there are those who respond in a political fashion at an individual level. Tibet has a very particular set of circumstances that mean it's problematic for temples and monasteries to get involved at an institutional level because of the potential fallout. I was in China myself a few years ago. We went to visit this very large monastery, the name of which just escapes me. Having a senior moment, I think. Anyway, it was a very lovely large monastery, and the abbot wasn't present. And we asked, why is the abbot not present? And they said, he has to be in the town, which is just kind of half a mile up the road. What do you mean he has to be in the town? Well, he has to be in the town so that the Chinese authorities can keep an eye on him, so he doesn't start doing anything too rash or political or whatever else. So it then perhaps does fall to individuals to take it upon themselves to make that political stance and declare their views, even in a startling way, like the monks and nuns who've set fire to themselves. But what about Western Buddhism? Where are we with all of this? Now, I know Robert Blunt, who did that study a few years ago about Western organisations in Britain. And he discovered that most of our Buddhist organisations are very small. You might say they're so small as to be insignificant in numbers, apart from the Tri Ratna community and the New Kadampa schools. But there may be another case about looking at this from an individual standpoint. Is there a difference between institutional Buddhist behaviour and individual Buddhist behaviour? What does this mean? There was a Manchester Conference of Buddhists a few months ago, which I attended, and there were some very scary people there. most of them from the Manchester Western Chant Fellowship. No, no, no. We have our own weirdness, but okay. No, there was a group of Chinese women there, and I can't remember the name of their organisation, but they were all dressed in uniform. They all had navy blue jackets on. They all had very kind of sedate, shiny blouses. They all had the same brooch holding the blouse shut at the neck. They all had the same skirt. They all had the same shoes. They all had the same hairdo. They all had the same blue ribbon tying their hair at the back. Now, there is nothing wrong with any of this, except it terrified me. Why were they all there in uniform? They were part of a sort of Buddhist humanist organisation that went out and gave aid to people in need. Well, we just don't kind of do that somehow with our Western Buddhists in the same way. Should we? You're right, they were from Taiwan. Yes. You know them, do you, May? But they go out and they do all these good works, okay? Our own Shifu, when the earthquake happened in Chengdu, organised loads of aid to go out there. When the Taiwanese earthquake happened, they sent nuns and monks out to go and do aid out there, okay? But somehow we don't quite do it, do we? Interesting. Purely anecdotally, it seems to me that many of the people who are attracted to Buddhism in the West are pretty independently minded individuals. Perhaps you have to be in order to be attracted to such a minority school in the first place. Some of those people, some of us, do come from a political background or one concerned with social change. And it seems to me that the lack of dogma associated with Buddhism seems to be part of the attraction for that group of people. But this apparent freedom from dogma is not necessarily as it seems. Our own Shifu published Orthodox Chinese Buddhism, which I bet not many of you have read. It is a scary document. Thich Nhat Hanh has also recently published a book called The Novice, which also takes quite an orthodox stance. In some schools of Buddhism in the West, the same old arguments rumble on about the acceptability of same-sex relationships as are expounded in the African churches. Dogma, whether it's culturally specific or not, abounds. So what is the difference between Buddhism and other religions? Is there a difference? Or have all these independently minded folk been hoodwinked by an esoteric framework that apparently gives freedom of action and thought? Well, let's have a look. Yesterday, Jan referred to the Dhammapada, verse 183, and I am going to do the same. So for those of you who weren't here yesterday, here's the Dhammapada, verse 183. And for those of you who were here yesterday, here's a refresher. In my simple transliteration, it says, do no harm, do good, and watch your mind. There's a woman called Valerie Roebuck who lives in Manchester who's just published a new translation of the Dhammapada available in Penguin Books, which I recommend to you. It's a very good translation, and Valerie Roebuck is one of those people who has a brain as big as a planet. She's very, very good. She says, not to do any evil, to undertake what is good, to purify your own mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. Now, this gives us lots of scope. We can get involved with good works, and we can avoid some activities that are bad for us, bad for society, bad for the environment, and bad for others. It is virtually a pronouncement to get engaged. But then that last line, to watch or purify your own mind, it's a bit harder, isn't it? It behoves us to be mindful, to practice mindfulness. But what exactly does that mean? Perhaps it means doing activities of body, speech, and mind in full awareness. But actually, it also means observing our own intentions and reactions in the midst of all that aware activity. And this is where it gets harder, for me at least, because as many of you know, I am no saint. To hold a level of awareness while you're doing something is one thing. To monitor my own reactions, surrounded by other people who are acting out their own stories and beliefs, while I'm responding consciously and unconsciously, while working out my own stories and beliefs, is a tall order. But frankly, that is the job in hand. And moreover, in the midst of it all, intentionally deciding what to do, what not to do, on the basis of it being good or evil too. But if we can crack this, in my opinion, and it's only my opinion, anything from thoughts to words or deeds can be engaged if we engage in this way. Now, I'm in danger of making this sound complicated. As I describe this, it seems grotesquely complex and in danger of blowing your mind with layer upon layer of analysis. But familiarity with it as a process reduces it to a simple background checking. This is easier to do when you're not in a highly agitated emotional state. It becomes hard to do when we're caught up in an emotional response to blame, hurt, accusation, and pride, for instance. We can also do this in a political setting as well as a domestic setting. The principle is exactly the same. And the point is that all of this is completely everyday. None of this needs to be special practice activity. I compare it with a framework of a set of rules to abide by to maintain the harmony of a community. Whatever you mean by community. That might mean your sangha. It might mean your political group. It might be the soup kitchen that you help out at. And of course, I'm describing something a little like the Vinaya, the rules for the monks and nuns. Both of these give a framework for self-observation and perhaps critical feedback from your peers. There's a fashion in management circles at the moment for something called 360-degree feedback. And I see some people going, oh God. I take it you've been subject to it. Okay. 360-degree feedback is where you get information from a range of people underneath you in the hierarchy, alongside you in the hierarchy, and above you in the hierarchy. And from this, you're supposed to get a more rounded view of how you're perceived, and also how you're thought to be performing. And that, in turn, is meant to give you insights into how you might develop and grow. You could also join a monastic community and get ordained and follow whatever number of precepts your gender demands, because remember, ladies, we have to have more precepts than the boys. I don't know whether it's because we're better at multitasking. Or whether it's because we've got more defilements that need sorting out. Take your pick. On the other hand, you can just get on with this in your daily life. And one of the ways of doing this is at work. The feedback from others is critical. 360-degree feedback notwithstanding, because there's all kinds of nonsense goes along with that as well. But the feedback from others is important, lest we start to believe our own stories or fall into the trap of thinking that we are something that we are not. Let me tell you a true story. I have a bizarre fantasy. Now then. My fantasy is about finding an urban cave under a railway arch in Manchester, probably near Victoria Station. I see myself in my fantasy as an urban yogin doing meditation in this railway setting. Bit like Cave in the Snow, but part-time and city-based. A railway arch is pretty cave-like. It's self-contained, it's covered from the elements, and it's away from the normal or the usual. There may, of course, be a few rats and mice and oil slicks to contend with. And in my fantasy, while I'm in my railway arch near Victoria Station, I'm watching the world and I'm watching myself. I'm practicing in the midst of noise and activity. And I'm doing what I might call city practice. Hold that thought, me with me oil slick and me rats, okay? Because I'm going to tell you another story. Recently, I came back from a holiday in Italy. For those who are interested, and you're probably not, I went to Lake Garda. And it was one of those organised trips, and there were about 50 of us on the trip. Okay? And we were duly bussed around to see the various sites. And sights, two spellings of sight, okay? And it was all very highly scripted and choreographed and scheduled. We went to see Juliet's balcony in Verona. We wandered around the Calais in Venice. It was all the usual stuff, okay? So we'd spend whatever amount of time on a bus going to wherever we were going. And then we had a bit of time to wander around there, and then we'd get back on the bus, and our guide would count us in. Bit like being at school, really. And one day, early on in the week, there was a couple who was sat in front of me, as it happens, on the bus, and they didn't come back. So the guide, bless him, he was a Belgian fella called Werner. He got a bit kind of irritated, you know. Oh, they're not here. And he went down his list and we got the names. Mr. and Mrs., let's call them S. Mr. and Mrs. S. Okay.
And so we just expected them to be a bit late. So we kind of sat there. La, 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 la. No. And they still didn't come back. And then Verna stopped being annoyed and started being worried. And he said, I'm going to have to go back and look for them. And at this point, we realised that none of us knew what they looked like. I managed to say, well, he's bald, but I only saw the back of him because he was in front of me on the bus. And somebody else said, well, she had no eyebrows, they were only drawn on. This is true, I'm not making this up. So poor Belgian Werner's trotting off, you know, down some Italian village looking for a bald fella and a woman with eyebrows drawn on. And we're kind of sat there, you know, and like it starts, and doesn't it, you know, they all start giving it this. What do they think they're doing? What do they think they're playing at? Bloody idiots. And then there were other people who were going, oh, no, you might have had an accident. Something terrible might have happened. You know. So we had one lot who were kind of just expressing their irritation. And we had another lot who were trying to be compassionate. I won't tell you which group I was in. Anyway, cut a long story short. Half an hour later, Werner comes back. He hadn't found him. He's been on the phone to everybody and his dog, the aunt phoned in nowhere. We don't know where he is. We don't know where she is. Okay. So we go back to the hotel and he's saying, I've never lost anybody before. Okay. And so we went back to the hotel, you know, and he got changed for dinner and he came down to dinner and lo and behold, Mr. and Mrs. S sitting there. And so people kind of went, I call it lemon lips. And people were saying, so what happened to you then? And what had happened was, we'd been on a boat trip and we were all instructed to get off at X place. And they'd not got off. I think they expected to be rounded up, you know, instead of acting independently. And they didn't, you know. Anyway, this is a very long story, and I'm kind of like going on a bit here, but you know, the point was, I found all of this a little bit irritating, okay? And it kind of got worse as the week went on, because every time we went anywhere, we then had to go through this routine of people saying to Mr. and Mrs. S, now remember to come back, won't you? You must come back in time. Shall we tell you when we have to get off somewhere? You know, and again, there was this kind of like compassion thing going on that was tinged with a bit of irritation. Okay. And I got really fed up with it. And the other thing on this holiday, I mean, it was a good holiday, don't get me wrong, okay? I'm not saying it was all rubbish, okay? But the other thing about this holiday that really wound me up was having to sit at the same dinner table all the time with some folk who had nothing to do with me. Now, this was more fascinating because you do that on retreat, don't you? You find your spot that first breakfast and that's where you are for the week. You know, and you're next to somebody who slurps their tea, it's just unfortunate. You're there all week. And on retreat, it doesn't bother me. But on the holiday, it did. And I'm kind of going, what's going on here? What's happening? Part of it was, just share a bit of personal information with you now that you don't need to know, but I've been on a diet, okay, and the woman of the couple that I was sat on the table with kept going, oh, you eating again, are you? I'm on a diet, not a fast. And I'd kind of decided I was going to cut myself some slack food-wise while I was in Italy. You know, I was going to let myself have the odd ice cream and whatever, you know what I mean? I wasn't going to hold back. And every time she said, oh, you're eating again, you know, this kind of like strangeness went on. My guilt was arising in me that I was indeed having an ice cream or a pudding or whatever else. Very odd. Now, I was telling my sutra group in Manchester about this the other Saturday, and I also told them about the railway arch. Do you remember the railway arch with the rats? Yeah, okay. And I told them about this, you know, and I was kind of going, oh, you know, because we like to talk about practical things in my sutra group. As you can see, it's not all terribly academic. And somebody in the sutra group said to me, you don't need a railway arch, Fiona. You need to go on more of them holidays. And the thing is, they are quite right. The bald, bumbling, missing man gives me direct insight into my views and responses, and also gives me an immediate opportunity to respond differently. Shall we say, to engage differently. So all of this is about getting on with the day-to-day, the mundane, the ordinary, and not seeing practice and doing this stuff as somehow separate from practice, separate from life, okay? Because engaged Buddhism is practice. Life is practice. And life is engaged. Now, there are lots of tricks of mindfulness that you can use. You can pause before you take a sip of tea. You can breathe consciously before you answer the phone. You can have an elastic band around your wrist and snap it now and again to remind yourself to wake up. Truly, these are all, you know, these are all real things. You don't know what you're laughing at. These are all real things. All real exercises in mindfulness, these. And they're all fine and dandy, and they're all so useful, but they're also a bit artificial. So is there a more direct way? Well, what about being at work? How to be engaged and actively applying your Buddhism rather than seeing Buddhism as somehow additional to life, another layer, if you like. Buddhism gives us parameters. It also gives us parameters, but I'm actually, you know, I just want to be, you know, because I'm Northern, and I just want to make sure that we've got that differentiation. I'm talking about parameters as in boundaries, okay? Buddhism gives us parameters. It gives us a shape into the way we might live and behave. And I have coined a phrase for this, and doubtless somebody's had it before me, but I call it applied Buddhism. And those people who come to my sutra group, are you listening, Felicia? You know, they're probably sick to death of hearing this because I go on about it all the time. Okay. And actually, this is the koan of Buddhism in the West for me. How do we apply Buddhism to the everyday? The old Zen adage is chop wood, carry water. And Charlotte Joko Beck, who is one of my favourite ever Zen authors, who Ken referred to this morning. She says, she has a kind of more modern transliteration for that, and she says, make love, drive freeway. She is, after all, American. Driving the freeway might be a bit too American for us, with respect to our foreign visitors. So we might say, feed the kids, do the weekly shop, keep the business going. Now, many people say that work is a particularly difficult environment in which to maintain practice, and this has been my experience too. Why is it? It's a place where we get carried away. We get carried away into a state of mind that is somehow not aware of our self, with a capital S, as we operate. We get sucked into habitual patterns. You might call them samskaras.
we get trapped by our roles. We're obliged to follow set protocols, bureaucracy, other people's frameworks. And we can lose our authenticity in all of this. Our true nature can get cloaked as we protect ourselves. From what? From our fear of failure. From our derision about the task. From our feelings about the organisation, or the manager, or the boss, or the owner. On the other hand, maybe we're trying to climb the greasy pole, looking for recognition, advancement, power, and money. Work is often connected with desires. I want this, I don't want that. In a time of high unemployment, such as we have now, including all the mass redundancies that are going on, it gets worse. People are saying any job is better than no job. And the power of collective bargaining has decreased in some circles as people feel less secure. It's best not to rock the boat. It'll be interesting to see the outcome of the ballot for strike action in unison that's proposed for the end of November. Some people are being politicised as never before, whilst others are concentrating on retaining some kind of position or salary or security. And the difficulty is, there is no right or wrong answer to this. People make their own decisions about what they can do. Engagement in this context is interesting, be that personal engagement, group engagement, or even institutional engagement. Where do we sit with all of this? I asked a group recently what were the fundamental things that they wanted that lay behind their reason for practice. Ask yourself, what is behind your reason for practice? What is it that you're after? The people I asked, some didn't know. Some wanted peace or equanimity. Others wanted not to feel pulled from pillar to post by circumstances or events or other people. Some wanted to get rid of that sense of something missing that David Loy might refer to as lack. One guy said that he didn't want anything. His life was pretty okay as it was. My sense is that we need to know what drives us, both in daily life and in our Buddhist search. Then we have some chance of pulling all of these together and getting back to what I am calling applied Buddhism. Buddhist lay life is about watching ourselves through these dilemmas and developing sufficient self-awareness to make choices about how we respond to them, and then watching the consequences arise. Joanna Macy, who's also been referred to today, says that Western life, especially Western work life, is turmoil. Life is complex, noisy, busy, and full of stuff. Relationships, material possessions, difficulties, gains and losses. Our engagement starts right here and moves outward if we so choose. This has to be part of the development of Buddhism in the West, the integration of Buddhist principles and what we learn about ourselves in the context of the information that we have access to. in order to see the effects and consequences of our behaviours at an individual, societal, and planetary level. What matters? How do you want the world to be? Where is the line between self and other? Where is the line between self and the world? What do we want to leave behind when we shuffle off this mortal coil? What are the implications for how I live my life? All highly pertinent questions. Anyway, I've had enough of rabbiting on a bit, so I need you to find a partner. Come on, find a partner. This is your participation.